This is Marketplace Money for the weekend of December 25th, 2009. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam, a world of investing.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is Marketplace Money. Don't know about you, but we here at Marketplace Money spent most of 2009 reeling and trying to recover from the events of 2008. At some point this year, the economic collapse got a new name, the Great Recession. And along the way, personal finance got some time in the spotlight. Shall we review? Why, yes, with some good friends of the show. First, welcome to personal finance columnist and author Liz Pulliam Weston.
Thank you, Tess.
Wall Street Journal columnist Jason Zweig. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Tess.
And Knight Kiplinger, editor-in-chief, Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine. Hi, Knight.
Well, good to be with you, Tess.
Let me start by asking each of you what you think the biggest personal finance story is of this year. We have a lot to choose from, housing, credit cards, Dow 6500, 10% unemployment. What was the most important thing that happened? Let me start with you, Liz.
Well, I have such a focus on credit that that's where my brain instantly goes. And I think one of the huge stories of this year was the credit card issuers and how they started not just beating up on the subprime people, but taking the schoolyard bully tactics all the way to the popular kids, you know, starting to raise rates and lower limits, even on people with good credit. We kind of knew that was going to happen, but the extent to which it happened, I think, shocked a lot of people.
I think it did shock a lot of people. You know, the amount of mail that we're getting from people who say, look, I pay off my bill every month on time. I have a great credit score, and yet they are either jacking my interest rate up to 30% or wiping out my credit line.
Yeah, we've been talking about how this could happen for years, that credit card companies can change the terms on a whim. They just chose not to with the people with better credit.
Yeah.
And now they're doing it to everybody. So people are seeing very graphically, yes, that they can take this agreement that I thought I had with them and upend it.
What do you think, Knight? Biggest story of the year?
I think it was housing. I think it was the further slide in home prices. And the house had become the piggy bank. Home equity was the driver of overconsumption, overspending, overborrowing in this decade. And now housing has returned to its rightful place as a place you live. It is shelter. It is not an investment.
If this is a good thing, however, what it did do was mean that people didn't have a store of cash that they thought they had, right?
Right. A lot of people were saving for their retirement in their home. And I feel very badly for those people that when their equity eroded, they're left without a broad array of financial assets, which should be the basis of future retirement security.
Jason, let me turn to you. We've talked now about housing and credit cards. What do you think was the biggest story of 2009?
Well, I wonder, Tess, whether the biggest story of 2009 is the one that didn't happen. You know, we went through the biggest boom and bust, arguably, since the Great Depression. And almost the entire American public was howling for the heads of investment banks and brokerage firms to be chopped off and marched on poles down Wall Street. And we did not have that kind of government response. So, you know, I'm not a Marxist by any means. I'm a diehard capitalist. But I am a little worried that the sense of justice that was meted out may not really have satisfied the underlying current of anger in society, and we may have another round of this before we're through.
Liz, let me follow up on that and ask you about where we have come since the outrage. You know, it seems like a lot of the people who did things right got punished along with the folks who perhaps weren't as wise as they should have been. What kind of lesson do you take out of that if you have been a responsible consumer?
Well, I think people have been scapegoating to some extent, and I think actually that made things a little bit worse because this housing crisis has been coming for a while, and there were a lot of people saying, I don't want my neighbor to get a bailout. Mm-hmm. That's not fair. Well, the problem is we're all interconnected, and when your neighbor loses his house, your value goes down, the crime in your neighborhood could go up. And as we saw, the entire economy is tied to our housing prices and what happens to them. So my feeling is if we'd been a little bit more generous with our neighbors, perhaps the economy might not have gotten so bad and this housing crisis might not have gotten so bad.
Part of the problem with scapegoating is the crisis was born of many, many factors, including bad habits of all of us collectively, the American people. Yes, there was mortgage fraud. There was very bad rating of highly risky securities. But abetting this was a broad spectrum of the American people who were not saving at all. The savings rate went to zero at one point, actually dipped negative for a while. So the responsibility is very, very broadly shared, and I think that has tempered the sense of revenge and scapegoating that we might otherwise have seen.
But I wonder then where people are supposed to place their anger, particularly when they see that the bailout has not gone to their neighbors, as Liz was suggesting perhaps it should have. The various mortgage rescue programs that have been proposed have not worked as well as perhaps people had hoped. It does seem that that not a lot of the rescue effort has made its way to the average consumer.
Tess, if I could just jump in for a second. You know, my dad, who was a very wise man, used to have a saying that when you point your finger at somebody else, at least three of your fingers are pointing back at you. And I think Knight makes a really perceptive point, which is that we really were all in this together. And of course, it's the overcompensated executives on Wall Street who took their firms down in flames and pocketed hundreds of millions of dollars in the process for themselves who make everybody annoyed because they're very visible. But there are 300 million people in this country, and we've really developed in the past couple of decades a bit of a culture of what we might call responsibility-free decision-making. And, you know, we did get to the point where you can pick up your pack of cigarettes that says right on the side of it, the Surgeon General says what you're about to do will kill you, and you can smoke them all day long. And then when you get sick, you sue the tobacco company. There comes a point at which people need to recognize that when someone offers you a loan you can't afford, it's not 100% the other person's fault, even if you didn't understand the documentation. And even if you were misled, something should have told you, I can't afford this.
That's probably the most remarkable part of this crisis is how widespread the guilt was. It wasn't just the government. It wasn't just corporations. It wasn't just borrowers. It was all of us together. And one of the things I see coming out of this that might be the silver lining is that people are realizing some of the personal finance basics that, you know, Knight has been preaching for years, that Jason and I have been talking about. You know, you got to have an emergency fund. You got to be saving for retirement, but looking at the risk that you're taking. I think one of the most tragic things was how many people so close to retirement were overdosed on stocks.
Well put.
Yeah, and they got the message just too late, you know, and their retirements have been totaled or decimated or at least put off because of these decisions. But now people are realizing what we were talking about and why it was so important.
One of the elements of the Great Recession that I think everybody would agree we all took a lesson from is risk. You look back 1 year ago as the market continued to tumble. We hit a low in March of this year, and a lot of people panic sold. What do you think that tells us about old rules versus any new rules that we need to learn or keep?
Tessa, I think one of the unappreciated lessons of the Great Recession is that it still makes sense to continue buying on a monthly or quarterly basis very systematically, even as markets drop. At Kiplinger, we were a champion of dollar cost averaging back in the 1940s when there was a deep fear of stock investing. I think we served them well with that advice, and I think it's still good advice.
I think the most important four words to listen for are, it's different this time. And there's different versions of that argument, and it keeps happening over and over. Anytime you hear that, you got to step back and be suspicious.
Let me finish up by asking all of you a final question, which is, what lessons do you think we still have not learned? Liz, let me start with you.
Oh, that's a tough one. I still don't think we have enough of the anti-bubble mentality. Mm-hmm. I still think we see people out there chasing returns and not fully integrating the idea of risk.
Jason, what have we not learned?
Well, I think one of the things we haven't learned, Tess, is that we don't learn lessons.
Oh, that's just sad.
They learn over specific lessons. So if you chased the hot returns of internet stocks in 1999 and then you lost all your money in 2000, the lesson you learned was not to chase the performance of internet stocks. So then you went out and you flipped condos in Fort Lauderdale.
Right.
And then you got wiped out on that. And now the lesson you've learned is don't flip real estate, but you're piling into gold. And if that's the way you learn lessons, then you haven't learned any lesson at all.
Knight, what do you think? What have we not learned, and might we learn it in 2010?
Playing upon Liz and Jace's responses, I think what we haven't learned is that a sensible plan that you put on autopilot with an asset allocation that's appropriate to your age, your tolerance for risk, your desire to sleep soundly at night will outperform a frantic chasing of the latest hot asset class any day, any year.
All right, I'm going to put you each on the spot and give you 30 seconds to tell me your one prediction that we will check in with you a year from now and see whether it came true, Liz.
Credit card companies will find new ways to annoy their users.
Oh, that's easy.
I know. Sorry. It's the first thing I could think of.
Knight?
I think that this year, quality blue chip stocks will outperform alternative assets.
All right. Jason?
People will look back at what happened and think they saw it coming all along. When in fact, they had no idea what was going to happen next. My colleagues on the panel do. But I'm talking about the people on Wall Street and their clients around the country. It's almost as if for a lot of American investors, this market crash never even occurred. The party seems to be starting up again. And a lot of people seem to have forgotten the pain that we've been through, and I'm a little worried about that.
Welcome to 2004. Jason Zweig, Knight Kiplinger, and Liz Pulliam Weston, thank you all, and I wish you all a very happy new year.
Happy holidays, Tess.
Bye-bye, Tess.
Bye. Thank you, Tess.
Marketplace Money is supported by Bank of America, working to meet the capital needs of qualified businesses and consumers. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/ahead. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Coming up, Chris Farrell and I review the financial resolutions we made back in January. Did we clean up our acts or keep things messy? Stay tuned for more Marketplace Money from American Public Media. If there's one thing we all learned over the last 12 to 15 months, it's that cash truly is king. Cash serves you better than any credit card will, and cash in the bank is safer than any stock pick. But can you take a love of cash too far by, say, hoarding coins? We decided to send Cash Peters to the World's Fair of Money for a better look at the fascination with pocketing more than a fair share of change.
You wouldn't think there'd be much interest in a money show, would you really? Not now we're switching to debit cards. Unsurprisingly, their PR guy, Jay Beaton, disagrees.
Money's 2,600 years old. We can trace our entire history through money. Everything about our society and our culture, we can trace through our money.
But it's dying out. So how do you feel about that?
I don't know if it's dying out.
I'm predicting the end of your show here.
Oh, I don't think so.
You may be right, too, because the hall was teeming with numismatists, that is to say coin collectors, buzzing around a vast acreage of display cases filled with exciting things like Estonian croons and Filipino treasury certificates. Or how about a bunch of rare American coins?
The value of coins is based on, first of all, how rare are they? The better condition they're in and the rarer they are, combined with other market forces to determine a value.
So if we were to break this case now and just run off?
We'd be shot.
Then I won't be doing that. But because world currencies are constantly changing, they attract hordes of collectors. They have three characteristics. A, most of them are men. B, a lot of them have ponytails. And C, what they do seems incredibly boring to the rest of us. Dealer Sandra Bamer.
A lot of them are not boring, but they are quiet and introverted. They're usually very smart. the problems getting a date?
Some of them. Some of them don't have any problem with that.
It's the ponytail, isn't it? That's the turn-off.
Of course it is. The show had several high points. The British Royal Mint had brought along its new range of coins. They're in colour. It's the latest thing. Meanwhile, the Canadian Mint was bashing out commemorative tokens that were cute but worthless, and not just because they're Canadian. You see, in my head, this is how Canadians make all their money.
They make them coin by coin,
one at a time.
I think the Winnipeg Mint can strike a million coins a minute or some crazy number like that.
Jeez. There was also a huge display case filled with millions of bucks in old currency. Jay again.
These are $100,000 notes. These were never made for general circulation, but they were made for bank transfers back in the day when you would hire a runner on a bicycle and he'd...
Now, the reason he stopped talking was because all of a sudden this huge guy walks up with a security guard, removes $1 million from the display case and starts posing for photos with it. Hello?
Who is this guy?
That's Hillbilly Jim, the wrestler.
Hillbilly Jim the wrestler?
He was a wrestler in like WWF for years and what have you.
No, that Hillbilly Jim, always kidding around. Turns out he's also a serious coin collector. He has the ponytail and everything.
It's just something about it. It's like, years ago when people used to collect stamps when we were kids, it's like a bug. It bites you and you just can't help yourself.
Is that right? Jim, though, was quick with a warning. If you're into collecting coins, do your research. There are rogue dealers out there who will skin you alive, the kind who give numismatism a bad name. And numismatism is a pretty bad name to begin with.
Every once in a while you hear a story about somebody coming in and saying, I don't know if this thing's worth much, and it's just a one-of-a-kind coin. And, of course, sometimes there have been stories of people letting them slip out of their hands for a little bit of nothing.
Now, you see, that's the danger. I was going to ask him a lot more, but the next thing I knew, he was wrestling with some guy from the U.S. Treasury.
Right, give it back to him. I don't want no IOU.
Boys. So instead, I went up to one of the dealers and asked, are you a crook? Jack Bayman.
If you polled 10 dealers and you would find maybe 5 out of 10 might try to pull a fast one.
Is this industry riddled with sharks?
Of course. Is the used car business riddled with sharks?
Yeah, but I think that these people kind of look like they might be too educated, intelligent.
I wouldn't say that you're a very good judge of character.
I agree with that.
Story of my life. In Los Angeles, I'm Cash Peters for Marketplace Money.
One thing I'll never understand about coins is how they can be worth more or less than face value. I mean, I know it's all about history and collection worthiness, but where else would you find something that says I'm worth 5 cents and it's actually worth $5,000? Well, commentator Joel Waldfogel says you could have found exactly that under the tree in the form of a gift.
With the smell of roasted chestnuts hanging in the air, this year's $65 billion gift-buying spree is strewn around the tree. Good news for the economy and happy, satisfied friends and family. Or not. Why doesn't our collective largesse amount to smiles all around? Turns out, we don't value the gifts given to us the same as we value things we buy for ourselves. Normally, we only spend $50 on something if it's worth at least $50 to us. But when we set out to spend $50 on each other, we aren't sure what to buy. We may buy something worth nothing to the recipient. For 15 years, I've surveyed people about the gifts they get versus the stuff they buy themselves. Turns out, that sweater Aunt Thelma paid $50 for, most people wouldn't pay more than $30 for it. But what about the joy of giving, you ask? Surely you can't put a price on that. Although you pay only $30 for that $50 sweater, her joy in giving it to you may add another $30 to the gift's total satisfaction. Then again, if you actually like the sweater, the gift could have created 50 plus 30, so $80 worth of satisfaction. Of course, it's also possible that Thelma is a sadist who only enjoys giving you sweaters you don't like, but I doubt it. I hate to be just a Monday morning quarterback, so here are some ideas for better giving next year. First, keep giving gifts to people you know well and see often, especially kids. Gifts from givers in frequent contact are far less likely to miss the mark than those from givers in only monthly or yearly contact. Second, when you must give but don't know what to buy, gift cards let recipients choose what they want while avoiding the awkwardness of cash. They'd be even better if their unspent balances, about $8 billion per year, went automatically to charity after a few years. Finally, gifts to charity on behalf of recipients deserve a look. Charity gift cards allow our recipients to choose the one that they feel would make the biggest impact and therefore have the most value. For this year and next, I wish you happy and efficient holidays.
Joel Waldfogel is an economist at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also the author most recently of Scroogenomics. Bah humbug. Well, you've made it through the holidays. Now it's time for all those great post-holiday deals, right? Right. Maybe it's time to head to the park for a walk instead. But whether you're braving the wilds of retail this weekend or not, we have some help for your issues with all the places where you do business. And Cheryl Harris is here to answer your questions for our call-in segment, Getting Personal. She is the consumer columnist at the Cleveland Plain Dealer and a good friend of the show. Welcome back, Cheryl.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
They say in a recession that it's the perfect time for scammers to go after people because they're desperate to make some money. And I wonder if you could tell us one of the most eye-rolling consumer scams you saw this year?
Well, there are many scams, but the one that actually it came to be packaged in a kind of funny way that I'll share. And I think it's a good scam in that I think that it can really be a very effective identity theft scam.
Uh-oh.
A friend of mine, she lists her phone number in her cat's names. So she knows when someone who's, you know, trying to just get her out of the phone book calls.
I'm going to use that.
Her new cat, Betty, has been getting these callers. Of course, my friend always says, you know, Betty can't talk right now. She only meows, right? But these callers were really insistent. They were saying, Betty's prescriptions are about to run out. And unless we get some information from her, we won't be able to continue sending them.
Oh, geez.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can see, because so many people order mail order prescriptions, that that might be something that panics them. And I think that that's a perfect example of just an identity theft scam. You know, try to panic someone. And then when they're a little bit panicked, try to draw out information that they wouldn't ordinarily give to someone on the phone.
Because most valid companies won't ask you for that over the phone, right?
Exactly. And if you do suspect, like if there's some reason that you think like your bank or, you know, your prescription company or someone's calling you, hang up and say, I'll get back to you. And then call the company through the regular number that you always use. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, you'll find out the call never originated from the company at all.
Good advice. Thanks, Cheryl. So shall we take some calls?
That'd be great.
Well, most credit card company offers aren't a scam per se, but they can raise some questions. And Andy in St. Paul, Minnesota is on the phone wondering about some of those. Hi, Andy.
Hi.
What kind of credit card offers have you seen lately?
Oh, I get offers every week, mostly from airlines offering a free round trip if I sign up for their credit card.
Yeah.
I've gotten one recently from Disney offering $200 in Disney rewards. And on and on.
You must be a pretty good credit risk because most people have seen those mailings drop off significantly over the last year or so.
I think they dropped off for a while, and now lately they've been coming back.
Well, there you go. So what kind of effect do these have on you? Are you going ahead and taking their offers?
I have not been taking them because I was a little worried that it might somehow negatively impact my credit rating if I were to then stop using the cards, because I would probably cancel the card, you know, within a year before they renewed for the next year.
Hmm.
Well, I don't believe that you need to be a slave to your score, but there are probably some things that you just ought to be aware of as you're making the decision on whether to get these cards or not. Your score can drop if you have too many recent credit card applications or credit inquiries by lenders. If you have too many new accounts, that can also bring your score down. If you have a credit inquiry that comes, like from a lender, that comes really near to the time that your score is pulled.
It sounds like what you're saying is maybe do a couple, but not too many.
I would do it sort of judiciously. And I would really not base it so much on like how much you can get back from all the cards, but really look at a card that will be most useful to you. And the other caution that I would just throw out there is there's fine print. You don't get the rewards until you spend so much on the card. And make sure that if you're going to cancel the card, there's not some penalty or some fee that comes with that. You just want to look through and tote up the benefits and the possible risks, I think.
But Cheryl, is there a way to game this system? I mean, could you apply for it? get the gift card and then cancel the credit card?
Sure you could. Your credit report will take a little ding. Your score will take a little ding from the credit inquiry. But if you close an account and you're paid up, you shouldn't be in bad shape. I mean, people get in trouble closing accounts whenever they close a lot of accounts or they close their oldest account or, you know,
right.
There's some other things that go into those formulas. But I would be more cautious about trying to open a series of these, like serially open these accounts, because then you're going to be amassing all this ability to get credit. And creditors get a little worried if you've got like way too much access to credit and that's not your usual game plan. They get a little freaked out about what you're doing, like why you're trying to get all these credit lines open. And so, you know, just rationally step forward, I guess.
That sounds like a good way to go.
All right. So do you have an offer right now that you're looking at?
Actually, I'm somewhat interested in Southwest Airlines. They've offered both my wife and me free round trips if we sign up, and that's an offer that's pretty hard to refuse these days.
There's probably an annual fee on that card, though, isn't there?
Actually, you're right. There is a small annual fee.
Yeah.
You know, you should also look, too, at the redemption rules for that, because I am hearing a little bit about blackout dates, and then if you want to get them in spite of the blackout dates, then you actually do pay a fee on top of that. So that fine print is so important right now.
So get out the magnifying glass, Andy.
Yes. At my age, I need to do that, yes.
I think at any age you need to do that. Well, good question, and let us know what you decide to do.
Thank you very much.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You can give us a call and ask your questions about life and money. Our voicemail is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or write us an email. Just use the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And we'll be back with more Getting Personal later in the show.
Marketplace Money is supported by Bank of America, working to meet the capital needs of qualified businesses and consumers. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/ahead. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. As we say on the show all the time, it is important to have financial goals, and we on the Marketplace Money staff are no exception. For 2009, I made some financial resolutions, and to keep me honest, I brought in our Marketplace Economics editor, Chris Farrell, on the deal, and he made some of his own. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tess.
So just remind us what you set out to do in 2009.
Two things. One, to organize my life, clean up the office.
Okay.
The other was to exercise more.
And remind us how those were financial resolutions.
Well, with my office, it's kind of like figuring out what do I have and what do I owe and where is it? I mean, organization is a big part of just, you know, getting a grasp of your financial life, bringing some order out of the chaos. And exercise, I believe, is one of the keys to working longer. And by the way, Tess, I'm the camp that believes I'm going to have to work for a long time because I know I can't save enough to fund the retirement that I'd like to have.
You and me both. Maybe I need to exercise and get organized too.
Well, what were yours?
Mine were, I had two as well, and one of them was to do a living will. My husband and I did not have one, and the other was to bulk up our emergency fund. So why don't we take ours one at a time? How is your office looking? We gave folks a photo in January, and it was quite a mess.
Oh, it's looking much better, Tess. It's
All
looking
right.
much better. It is. However, if we were talking 2 months ago, you might have been able to see me somewhere behind the books and papers piled on my desk. So I can't claim that I've been doing this all year, but I am now making progress. So maybe it's a biannual resolution.
Fair enough. And exercising?
Exercising. Now, here's the trick. I did a lot of walking, did a lot of biking. And now what I've done for 3 months, temporary, it's a test. I've joined a health club because I don't know about you, Tess, but you know, I just realized that when it's 20 below zero, I don't like getting my exercise outside. So I'm going to try now doing a little more weightlifting and see if I can be more disciplined. So I've made progress, but not as much as I'd like.
Okay. I would give you a B then.
All right. All right.
I'll give you a B instead of a C.
All right. Now, how about you?
Well, like I said, I got 50% of it done.
Give us the good stuff first.
Okay. The good stuff is we now have a living trust. We did find an attorney that did the whole package for a flat fee. We have, you know, our advanced medical directives. We have a will. We have pour overs. We have, you know, all the stuff that, that you need. You know, it's interesting, Chris. The one thing that I was wondering how to take care of was our animals. You know, both
sure.
you and I are animal people.
Yep.
And this attorney said that he had a lot of clients who basically just put an amount in their will that would go toward the care of the pets for anyone who took them.
Mm.
So that's what we did.
Oh, I like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. So they'll be taken care of.
Congratulations. I think this is wonderful. I mean, you should feel good.
We did feel good.
As far as I'm concerned, you're doing really well. But what's the one that you fell short on?
Oh, and this is really embarrassing to admit because it's something that we tell all of our listeners to do. We did not bulk up our emergency fund as much as I had hoped. And I really have no excuse for it. You know, both of us were very lucky that we kept our jobs this year in a year of 10% unemployment. But we right. just weren't disciplined to set aside that money.
Tiny steps for tiny tots. You know, you just got to make a little bit of progress, not a whole lot. You know, this is something that you build up over time. So I wouldn't be too hard on yourself.
Okay. Well, let's not be hard on ourselves at all and just be proud that we did make some progress and vow to have more progress next year.
And you know, Tess, it's a journey, not a destination.
Very good. I think we'll have to put that on a poster if it's not already. Happy New Year, Chris.
Happy New Year.
Coming up, we visit once again with the ladies of the formerly Baroque Investment Club. They're not Baroque yet, but...
In March, we were so despondent and feeling that it wasn't as much fun as it had been the year before.
Hard to imagine a time when the stock market was fun. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We are back with more Getting Personal to take on your questions. I'm here again with Cheryl Harris. She's a consumer columnist at the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Cheryl, we are ready with some more callers with consumer problems. Are you ready to deal with this?
Sure thing.
The gift of the gift card has exploded in the last few years, I think you would agree. Did you get any this year?
No, I hate gift cards, but I know people love them.
They do.
They love to give them.
They do. And, you know, it's easy, small, portable. Just slip it into a greeting card. It's all done. But there are some downsides, as Jan from Memphis, Tennessee has found out. Hi, Jan.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. So what has happened to you with your gift card?
It's called a vanilla card, MasterCard.
Vanilla? I'm not familiar with that.
I guess it can be used anywhere.
Oh, okay.
In a few venues, it's actually been declined, and one of the most aggravating examples I can think of is going into a restaurant, totaling up $51 on a $100 vanilla card, and then going somewhere the next day and finding out that it's declined, and I go to the microscopic 800 number on the back of the card and find out I've got a negative balance, and 5 days later, everything's okay.
Well, have you ever heard of this, Cheryl?
You know what? It sounds to me, and this is really kooky because I haven't heard about it on gift cards, but it sounds to me like blocking, like on a credit card where you go to use one, say, at the gas station and you get $30 worth of gas and they block out a bigger amount. So they block out $50 on your card.
Yes.
There are two kind of different cards here, and the rules are a little bit different for each of them. Some of them are store-specific cards. So mm-hmm. let's say, you know, a store or a restaurant, and they issue that card. That's their card. And state law says what's going to happen with those cards. And Tennessee's law says if you buy a store-specific gift card, it has to be good for 2 years. It can't charge you fees in that time. So you have to retain the whole face value for 2 years. Now, when you get to those multi-store cards, a lot of states left that to the feds. And when Congress just did credit cards, reform, it has said that there are going to be some gift card reforms. They don't go in place until August of 2010.
Okay.
You know, I don't know if they're going to affect blocking, but blocking is not going to be allowed on a credit card. So I wonder if some of the rules that they write might not prevent this blocking on gift cards as well.
Well, that's a really interesting question. And, you know, I suppose this is really a warning to folks who are buying these cards for people that you have to look at the restrictions that are going to be placed on it.
Yeah, I hate looking a gift horse in the mouth.
Right.
Boy.
Right.
It's embarrassing most of all.
Of course it is. Having anything declined when you're at the checkout counter is just so humiliating.
And they always call gift cards the gift that keeps taking, because those multi-store cards, you know, have had these fees attached. They've had non-use fees and other fees that just eat up the value.
Mm-hmm.
The basic rule for these gift cards is use it or lose it. Use it fast. If you've gotten one for Christmas, go use it.
You could move here to California, where the law is that gift cards never expire. So that would be another option for you.
I can afford it.
Oh, we welcome everyone here in California. Well, really good question. I bet a lot of people are going to be facing that over the next several weeks. So hopefully this provided some answers. So go use your card.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye. Our phone number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. We spell that M-O-N-Y, and you can leave a message for us there. Or write us an email. You'll find the Getting Personal link at our website, marketplace.org. Kristen in Dayton, Ohio, is our next caller, and she had some problems getting a gift earlier this holiday season. Hi, Kristen.
Hello.
So what happened?
It was kind of a gift for myself, for me and my husband. We were looking at a video camera, and I've been watching it for the past couple of months because we knew we wanted to get it. There were three different stores that had it on sale. There was one for $150 off the original price, and that happened to be H.H. Gregg. And when I went there, they said that they did not carry that one.
Hmm.
But I didn't know how, like, they could have it in their national ad and not carry it at all in any of the stores.
Well, first of all, I have to ask you, being in Los Angeles, is H.H. Gregg, is that a department store?
H.H. Gregg is appliances and cameras, stereos, and vacuum cleaners. It's large and small appliances.
Okay, well, you're in Dayton, and Cheryl is in Cleveland, so Cheryl, you must be familiar with H.H. Gregg.
We're practically neighbors. Yeah, that store is around. It's a big chain.
Well, what do you think about this? I mean, advertising for a product that you don't even carry.
So here's the thing. If you advertise something and you don't have it in stock, and you get people to come to your store, really that's called bait advertising. I mean, that's what it is. But under Ohio law, if you go to a store for an advertised item and they don't have it, they're supposed to give you a rain check if you ask for one. And you have the right to buy that item at the advertised price, and they have 60 days to get it to you, like to get it in their store. And you have to go pick it up within 14 days of when they tell you that it's arrived. That's sort of the rule. But there are some exceptions, and I want to go over these because retailers do have some outs. They don't have to give you a rain check if they advertise right up front that the items that they have for sale are clearance or special purchases, or if the ad clearly says there are no rain checks, then they're off scot-free. But they have to make both of those disclosures. It's clearance and there are no rain checks. It's a seasonal item and there are no rain checks. So they have to do both of those things. They also don't have to give you a rain check if they clearly state in the ad that there is a minimum quantity that's in stock at each store. So it might say, well, at least 10 are in stock, or only two in stock at each store. And if you go through flyers, a lot of times you see that kind of wording beside those sales. So I'd go back, I think, and take a peek at that ad and see if those disclosures are there.
So, Kristen, I guess the lesson here is to read the circular before you head to the store, but then you may have some options once you get there if there is no merchandise.
Okay.
And you also may, Kristen, you might try to contact the store, like the, you know, write a letter to the store president and say, this is what happened to me, and I think it's wrong, and I spent $50 more than I would have to buy this at your competitor. And they may be willing to do something for you, too. I mean, they may be willing to make it up to you with a gift certificate or something. So just take it up a notch from customer service.
Okay.
Go for it.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call, Kristen.
Bye.
Well, you can leave your questions at our voicemail. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can always write us an email. You'll find the Getting Personal link at our website. It's marketplace.org. And as always, you should check with your own financial professional if you're about to make any big money decisions. Meanwhile, Cheryl, thank you so much. It's always great to have you on the show, and Happy New Year.
Thanks. It was really fun.
And one more thing to note this week, in answer to your many questions about COBRA healthcare coverage, The federal subsidy that was paying 65% of COBRA insurance bills was set to expire, but the president has signed legislation to extend that subsidy to 15 months instead of 9, and eligibility lasts until the end of next February instead of the end of this year.
Marketplace Money is supported by Bank of America, working to meet the capital needs of qualified businesses and consumers. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/ahead. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. And finally, on this last Marketplace Money of 2009, we began the show with our experts in personal finance. So what better way to end than with some old friends who you might call a microcosm of this year's stock market roller coaster? They're just regular old investors. The Ladies of Formerly Baroque, an investment club in Northern Virginia. The club is one of three I profiled throughout 2007. By the end of that year, their investing decisions brought a 16% return worth more than $137,000. By the end of 2008, those numbers sounded a bit like fiction. Their account held less than half that, and two members of the club dropped out. Seems it's not nearly as much fun to lose money as it is to make it. So we thought we'd check in and find out how 2009 panned out for them. And I'm joined by three club members. Dee Cardiff, hello.
Hi, Tess.
And June Shalhoub, hello.
Hello, Tess. How are you?
And Pat Meadows as well. Hi.
Hi, Tess. Nice to be back with you.
I'm so glad that you guys could come on and give us a bit of an update on how the club did this year. Pat, let me start with you. Was 2009 a little more kind to you than 2008 was?
Yes, it was. Not a whole lot kind like 2007 was, but we did much better this year than we did in 2008.
So where is the club's total right now?
The club's total is about close to $54,000. And as we told you, at one point, we lost four members.
Right.
So that added up to almost $27,000 that we had to pay out. We started the year at about 50, and we're, as I think right now, we're at close to 54. But of the 27 we paid out, 10 of that was this year.
10 of that was this year. Okay.
Yes.
So you lost a couple of members again this year?
Yes. We lost two last year, and we lost two this year.
What was the explanation for that, June? Was that cold feet on the part of a couple of the ladies? Were they just tired of losing money?
Actually, there were different reasons why they left. One left because she no longer found the club as much fun, and we were losing money, and it was too stressful for her.
Well, Dee, let me ask you about that. I would imagine that that was probably a common feeling amongst club members, was it not?
Yes, it really was. We all were feeling kind of down about it, but now we're left with a really strong core group of eight members who are willing to make it work and make money.
Okay. Well, let's talk about how you did that this year. It sounds like you made, what, $4,000 or $5,000 total. Now, if you look at how the stock market did, of course, we hit bottom in March, but then there was a 50, 60% run-up after that. How and did you take any advantage of that, Pat?
We changed some of the stocks that we had. One foreign stock, we stayed with it. Even though we had more than a 50% loss in that stock, we decided to hang on to it and see what happened. And it came back a whole lot quicker than anything else we would have purchased at the time.
And what was that?
HXM.
What do they sell?
Home builder out of Brazil, I believe. And we went back to Apple.
Yeah, you've gone back and forth, sold and bought that several times, haven't
right.
you?
Right, and did fairly well on that. And then picked, I think we have quite a diverse range now. We have, we're mostly in large caps. We focus on growth stocks over value stocks. We have about 52% in U.S. stocks and 37% in foreign stocks, and then the rest is in cash.
June, as I mentioned, the Dow, at least, hit bottom in March. Can you describe for me what the club discussions were in the first couple of months of the year and then perhaps how that changed, if at all, over the course of the year?
in March, we were so despondent and feeling that it wasn't as much fun as it had been the year before. That's when we began to enter into some of the old steady eddies, such as McDonald's, J&J, said, okay, let's get stocks that will maybe not go down. They might not make us a lot of money, but at least they are the steady ones. And J&J, of course, gives a dividend, and so we stayed with it. As we saw it go up, we felt confident. We sold our McDonald's, and we have done a lot of studying and a lot of discussion, and we feel confident that we're making good decisions.
Dee, why did you sell McDonald's?
We had made a profit first, and then it started to go down, and we thought, we've learned this lesson before. Let's sell before it really tanks on us. We're always kind of reevaluating and trying to learn from past mistakes. And of course, there are always new things out there, and it doesn't always work.
Pat, I know a lot of people learned lessons last year in 2008 as they watched the market tank. What do you think the lessons are from this year, as there's been such a bounce back in the last few months?
Well, I think that we are not as trusting as we were in 08, when the people that were supposed to know what was going on kept saying, okay, we've hit bottom, it can't get any worse, and it did. And then a month later, it can't get any worse, and it did. So I think we trust our own research a little bit more than we used to, and take more time to do the research rather than trusting just what we're hearing. I think that, like June said, we picked some of the old standards that were not in trouble. We didn't have any financial stocks and stayed with those. The bottom of our market was also in March, and we've come back over $10,000 since then. And, I think we're right now we're pretty proud of ourselves.
Well, let me ask each of you what your hopes are for the next year as we head into 2010. Are you feeling confident about your investments, or are you kind of once burned, twice shy? Let me start with you, Pat.
We are cautiously optimistic. I think that we've decided that we want to have more fun this year. We're going to do some outside activities as a group also, so that we can have some fun. And then we started last year having a learning presentation at each one of our meetings. So we're always learning.
Dee, what about you? You were talking earlier about how it has been difficult, and it's never fun to lose money. So how do you keep the interest as you go into 2010?
We noticed little signs that the economy is picking up. I know I notice it in my small business. So I'm very confident that the market will go up, and we will watch for good stocks, but not expect to make those soaring profits like we did in the past.
And June, as you look back on 2007 and how exciting that was, and then the last 2 years, not so exciting, I wonder, does that put your focus more on the long term than it has been?
It does put the focus on the long term, and you're right, 2008 wasn't as much fun at first, but when you get down to 8 members, you share so many fun activities that you've done, and you do things more together, and you do a lot of laughing. I feel such optimism. I think this 2010 will have a nice, steady growth, I'm hoping.
Well, I love to hear that that you're all still laughing through the gains and the losses.
Right.
Right.
Well, great to talk to you all, and I'll hope to get out and visit you sometime in 2010. But until then, happy holidays and a very happy new year.
Thank you, Tess. Same to you.
Happy new year.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. We'll give the remaining seconds of our final show of 09 over to a couple of kids who don't have to worry about budgeting, but tend to worry about lots of other things. Peppermint Patty, take it away.
Have you made any New Year's resolutions, Chuck?
Yes. You know how I always dread the whole year? Well, this time I'm only going to dread one day at a time.
Oh, Charlie, don't despair. The decade of asset bubbles, greed, and financial stupidity is over. at least till the next one. All right, speaking of the next one, next time on the show, we'll meet some people who give away half their income. And it's not just folks with dough to spare.
They always say, let rich people take care of it. My making less doesn't get me off the hook, you know?
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Troe. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. Don't take my parking spot at the mall. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, working to solve America's retirement savings challenge through innovation, service, and performance. Putnam, a world of investing.
American Public Media.